and nearly all systems of philosophy, both Eastern and Western, seem to agree that there is room for improvement in that part of man which he terms himself. If, however, he assumes that this person, this self, is merely a long ray of divinity, then he is against a rather complicated situation, because a divinity under these conditions would seem to be the inevitable cause of absurdity in a great many cases. The individual, being full of errors and weak of spirit, would seem to bear witness to a divinity that was deficient in many things. Neither Eastern nor Western philosophy will accept this. They will not accept that the God power in any organism is in itself inadequate. Rather, the attitude is that we are mistaken in attempting to determine what part of man's nature is essentially divine. That we have substituted in a subtle way mind for spirit. That we have assumed that intellect is the highest part of man, and that to the degree that he thinks, he is divine, even though his thoughts are not divine. If, however, the mind was the God in man, we could scarcely face the history of civilization and explain it rationally, for it is a continual record of trial and error, of absurdity and crime. It is a record of man's inability to govern his own affairs or the affairs of others. Thus, we must begin to isolate in some way the personal self which we experience from this larger self which we do not experience. In the Gnostic system, the larger self was the over-self, Emerson's over-soul. That there was something in man that is superior to the self as we know it. And while lacking facilities for analysis, we can only assume that this is a plus kind of self. We must assume that inside of man there are also levels, and that the level of the mind is not identical with the level of consciousness itself. If this be acceptable, and there is so much evidence to sustain it that we can hardly argue the point successfully, then the nature of the self becomes a serious issue in philosophy and has been given a lot of attention in Vedanta, in Zen, in Buddhism generally, in yoga, in Tantra, and in the mystical sects of the Near East, the early Christian mysteries, the Egyptian and Greek schools, and even among the more civilized peoples of the Western Hemisphere in ancient times. Every nation gradually ascending the cultural ladder has come to the point where it has had to face the source of right and wrong as social forces. And the only way in which this source could be found, apparently, was within man himself. Therefore, there has to be a fountain of right and wrong in man. Now, right and wrong do not necessarily become identical with good and evil. Right and wrong seem rather to be correctness or incorrectness of judgment. An individual does not always do wrong because he is evil. He makes mistakes because he is ignorant. We cannot necessarily convict the ignorant person of being evil, but he certainly is not in a condition of internal resource to achieve the greater good for all concerned. Therefore, rightness to our common thinking becomes a proof of sound judgment, wrongness of unsound judgment. And man is capable of both forms of judgment. And whatever part of man is therefore polarized between right and wrong judgment cannot be regarded as infallible. The Buddhist system, therefore, perhaps offers as clear a picture as we can find of the concept of selfness. Of course, Buddha did not originate the notion. He merely borrowed from certain of the earlier Brahmanic and Hindic teachings. And these, in turn, perhaps, fuse with others in the remote past to form one vast and mysterious amalgam of ancient beliefs. In any event, however, he did clearly point out that we must assume that man is divisible into three essential levels or conditions of being. The highest of these may be considered to be reality itself. And with our present equipment, we seem to have no skill in determining the nature of this reality. Reality is more than a hypothesis, however. Reality is an essential according to the experience of consciousness itself, but it cannot be defined by the consciousness that accepts the need for it. Reality must in some way, therefore, remain always and forever the thing as it is. Of the nature of things as they are, we are notably deficient in knowledge. We hardly know what we are. We are unable to turn to another person and with a few quick remarks determine the nature of that person as he is. We are forced, therefore, to assume that reality is because everything that exists has to have an essential, factual nature of some kind. But the essential fact is, in the case of the creation of which we are a part, always hidden. It is hidden behind the veil of first cause or of eternal causation. Most philosophical systems favor eternal causation. Most religious systems favor first cause. Whether we consider, however, causation to be a beginning or an eternal process, its nature and substance is beyond definition. We have never in the history of human knowledge been able to create an ample and sufficient definition for the nature of absolute being. And there doesn't seem to be any probability that we will do so in the near future. This concept of essential or absolute being, however, is one that has to exist because there has to be some kind of a fact behind all appearances. For all appearances are themselves aspects of fact. All living things must therefore bear witness to life, even as all intellectual things must bear witness to intellect. All created things must bear witness to a creating force, pressure, or principle. Thus, the root of all things is inevitably in being itself. We have no proof whatever that this being has ever directly addressed a person. We have no proof whatever that this total being has ever been personalized in the sense of presenting a personal nature of any kind. Yet we are assured that this unpersonal or impersonal thing is the source and root of an infinite diversity of personalities. Yet all these personalities have one weakness in common. They are unable to adequately define their own source. Now this is the primary of the Buddhist concept. And the concept of the condition of this is, of course, concealed under the general terminology of the Mahaparinirvana, or the state of absolute, unconditioned existence. This is the goal of Southern Buddhism, with the monk attempting the complete elimination of all conditioned existence to restore identity with an utterly unconditioned existence. To do this, he must cease to be a being or person. He must no longer have any of the conditioning or qualifying attributes of mind, emotion, or sensation. Assuming that such a condition would be conceivable, Western scholars have generally taken the ground that to remove all of the attributes by which the individual can experience or interpret experience must leave this individual in a vacuum. Therefore, that actually parinirvana is extinction. Buddha says no, it is not, but admits frankly that the consideration of its essential nature is not only impractical, but impossible. The second sphere or area of Buddhist contemplation, therefore, is what might be termed in modern psychology the subconscious nature of man. The subconscious nature of man is an area of subjective growth. This area of subjective growth surrounds the central core. It is made possible because the core exists. It is made possible because the essential root energies of the subconscious are derived from this thing, which is not well described as superconscious, but is certainly extraconscious so far as we know. This so-called subconscious, therefore, is built up not from the conditioning influence of being, but from the conditioned influence of environment. The subconscious world, with its psychic pressures, its psychic problems, and all of the various records of psychic intensities, must therefore be held to be a subjective personality. The subconscious is not essentially different from the conscious external person. Rather, it is the submerged part of the objective consciousness, which, like the iceberg, has most of its mass submerged. Thus, the so-called objective personal consciousness of man is a fragment floating on the surface, and beneath this surface is the greater part of the mass of this nature, which we call the subconscious. The subconscious exercises the conditioning effect upon the personality. The subconscious is the depository of the records of the reaction of man to experience and condition. Therefore, into the subconscious, as into a capacious memory, is gradually stored away all the experienced phenomena that we know. Psychology today thinks of the subconscious as merely a one-life instrument. Eastern thinking considers the subconscious not as a one-life instrument alone, but as carrying within it the impulses and pressures of the entire cycle of rebirth. However, as the objective man is not aware of his relation to karmic indebtedness, so the subjective man may not be either. But as objective incidents are conditioned by karmic laws, so subjective reflexes and attitudes are conditioned by karmic laws. If then we are really looking for the so-called self or the ego, we are inclined to suspect that it lies in this subconscious nature, that the subconscious nature represents the manager or directional power over the objective personality. that the objective personality and the subjective personality are the hemispheres of one sphere, and that what we call experience moves back and forth between the visible and invisible hemispheres of the conscious and subconscious nature of man. Thus, perhaps, in our Eastern philosophy, we have a parallel to modern psychological thinking. That somewhere in this mystery of the subconscious lies the chemistry which produces the mystery of self. That self is this area of subconsciousness. That it represents the consequence of certain experience being continuously pressed back into a subconscious container. That this experience is in various degrees of maturity, that it is influenced constantly by the various levels by means of which man accepts or receives into himself the stimuli which produce knowledge, wisdom, understanding, growth, reflex, and reaction. Outside of this subconscious self, which is the second circle, if the like of this concentric bullseye target, is a third or objective circle. And this is the circle which really extends to the outer circumference of man's body, the skin. It is in this circle that the objective consciousness exists with its final relationship to the environmental world. This third, or so-called conscious being, is simply man living in this world, according to the experiences of this world, acting and reacting according to the immediate stimuli of this world, and passing through a wide cycle of diversified activities as a result of the region in which he exists as a physical being. This objective body contains within itself, this physical personality contains within itself a series of sensitive areas which we call sensory perceptions. The purpose of these sensory perceptions is to sense, and that is to become aware of. And these sensory perceptions may also be regarded as perceptive, namely that they do sense, that they perceive, that they are continually taking in to themselves stimuli from the exterior or from the outer world. A continuous bombardment of phenomena and of physical sensations move in through the sensory perception and finally perceptions and finally unite as a result of the common sense or the mental coordinator. And the mental coordinator is Buddha's sixth sense. It is this sense which must put together all of the fragments of external phenomena and make something out of them. And what it makes out of them causes the individual who possesses this instrument to suddenly declare, "This I believe," or "This now becomes evident to me," or perhaps with a little greater gusto he will say, "This is so." It is so because it is testified to by a certain coordination of sensory perceptions. Yet we know from the beginning of existence that these sensory perceptions are not infallible. We know that under normal conditions they are usually adequate. We know that if the individual does not abuse them, or if they are not injured, or in some way lose their proper sensitivities, these sensory perceptions produce a constant stream of testimony, and that these testimonies are reasonably consistent with the phenomena over which they exercise sensory power. Thus, when the eyes say, "This is a tree," we have a right to assume that the tree is there. Although, of course, we must agree with Aristotle that the word tree gives us no clue as to the real nature of the thing we see. It only represents its shape and the species which we have associated with it. All the terms by means of which we make meaning out of perception are terms which we have applied to the various things that we receive by sensory impulse. But there is no denying that when we say there is a table, there is something that for all practical purposes resembles a table. There is no doubt that when we hear a sound, that what we hear is our own interpretation of a rate of vibration, that this rate of vibration has been recorded and is being carried into the mental coordinator within ourselves, where the nature of this vibration is more clearly differentiated and we decide whether it is concordant or discordant. Thus, we are constantly receiving these testimonies. But the next problem that we have to face is that all operations of sensory perception depend upon the condition of the organism through which they pass. Not only must we consider the nature of the thing seen, but we must also figure the nature of the thing seeing if the validity of the phenomena is to be determined. Now, there are certain common things about which this validity problem is comparatively unimportant. If a number of us at the same time seem to see that it is raining, it is probably raining. Our testimonies of sense perception will leave no great difficulty of understanding this. But no one yet in this world has ever been content to let it rain. Whenever rain is noted, something has to be done about it. Wherever we turn in our way of life, sensory reflexes are subject to continuous interpretation. And interpretation is nothing more or less than previous experience applied to new experience. The individual forever seeking to solve the mystery of the unknown by recourse to that which is already either known or believed. If it is already known, his new interpretation may be adequate. If it is only believed, his new interpretation may be inadequate. So constantly and continuously in our way of life, phenomena entering into the experience of man through the sensory perception is subject to modification in that most vital of all areas, the mental coordinator. We know outwardly, for example, that if a person goes to school who has no interest in the subject, he will not learn well. Now, one of our problems today is to try to determine what kind of education is suitable to various persons of various attainments and attitudes. It is quite obvious that what we cannot use in this world, we almost certainly abuse. What we cannot understand, we must inevitably misunderstand. We are so constituted that this is the way life operates. If this be true, then, this determination of the nature of phenomena is subject to the continual interpretive power of the mental coordinator. And this mental coordinator has in turn a very conditioned kind of existence. Because for the most part, this coordinator builds its philosophy of life from its environment. Thus, an individual, we will say, looking out into the world and seeing a world torn by war as we have at the more or less at the present time, certainly torn by the constant fear of war. Greece needs coordinator receiving the continual sensational justification of the general misery of external conditions may gradually become atheistic, because there is no evidence to that coordinator through its constantly increasing experience with externals that there is anything good in the world. This coordinator, however, in the midst of all of the confusion and war, may experience personally the significance of affection, regard, or love. Suddenly the coordinator receives a new kind of testimony. But this testimony may be met with the gravest of suspicions as the result of other testimonies from society as to the present condition of human emotional and social relationships. So what we gradually have is a mental coordinator contaminated by its own external environment. Just as a child brought up in a very unhelpful environment may have its moral nature disturbed simply because this disturbance is constantly carried into the coordinator. The coordinator can have no opinion or no attitude superior to the sum of the interpretation of the sensory perception. Thus we have a little closed package here, a little circuit of circumstances, in which the individual, having been set in a belief by any situation, begins to censor his own sensory perception. He declines to accept as valid any sensory message that conflicts with the opinion of the coordinator, who now becomes a little despot. He now becomes a little fixation, perhaps utterly intemperate, utterly intolerant, completely bigoted in some way. He may be the absolute skeptic, or he may, by some other interpretation, be the easy believer, so gullible that he falls for every notion that occurs. But in any event, this coordinator now develops the same kind of censorship tactics which we often observe as a misfortune in human society. It simply fails to register what it does not want to register. Or it completely disproportions the values of what it does register. The small act of the friend becomes more important than the passing generosity of an adversary. The individual is more responsive to flattery than he is to criticism. He is more inclined to accept the opinions of those who agree with him than contrary opinions that may be wiser and better. So little by little, this coordinator builds a subjective, integrated personality, invisible, but which constitutes the true character of the person in the body which we see. This character, with its weaknesses and its strengths, with its mistakes and its virtues, with its blind spots and its death spots, with its thoughtlessness and its thoughtfulness, with its inclinations to fear and to worry, with its uncontrolled jealousies and its unreasonable ambitions. All this conglomeration simply represents this endless motion of external phenomena moving inward to a coordinator that is using it to continually build the dominant attitude which it wants. The dominant chemistry finally comes to the top, takes control of the rest, and we have what we call a personality. This personality is certainly subject to continuous change, but where it is once locked by an extremely adamant situation, a completely unchanging determination to accomplish certain purposes, or with complete determination to continue exactly as it is in all habits and in all practices, this person can resist a tremendous amount of change. This individual can be taught without learning, can see numerous examples of the mistakes that it makes without changing, and can cheerfully and willingly maintain a bad disposition, fully knowing that it is bad, but because that is the disposition it desires to have. Somewhere in this mystery muddle and mix-up slowly emerges the vision of this thing we call the self that senses. This self, which is the summary of the sensory processes, is the self which most of us know. We do not know why it acts as it does. We do not know why it gets us into trouble morning, noon, and night. But we do realize that it is a continually conditioning influence, and that in most instances, that which it wishes will be accomplished. That which it determines will be done. And its every whim will change the life of the person into conformity with that whim. So man's inner life becomes a strangely distorted shadow of that which it might be. And out of this conglomeration becomes the only self that we really know anything about. And in many instances, it is pretty poor. Yet we also realize that there exists in the world, and always have existed, certain persons in whom the self seems to be doing better. We realize that this self, with all its conglomerates and all its mysteries, does not produce only confusion. That out of this self also there emerges genius. That out of this peculiar subconscious mystery has come not only the Hitlers, but the Leonardos. Not only the Caesars and Napoleons, but the Beethovens and the Raphaels. We realize that out of this same compound must also have emerged through experience those persons who have suddenly sensed the need of a superior standard of living. That some way this self will and can testify against itself. That it can in some cases develop direct revulsions against its own limitations. And that out of the constant confusion comes finally the great lesson, namely that there will only be confusion. That either the entire pattern has to be reintegrated, or the individual will continue to be his own worst enemy till the end of time. So nature does not intend this to happen. Therefore, the very processes of error which arise within the subconscious become unendurable. They force us to correct in order to survive. And the principal instrument by means of which this corrective is induced, of course, is physical pain and mental suffering, or emotional suffering. The individual gradually discovering that the intemperance of the coordinator is destroying his peace of mind and his common good, ultimately begins to investigate this matter. Ultimately begins to experience a new quality within the mind itself, and that is the quality of misfortune arising from wrong conduct. Out of this pattern, the mind itself begins to develop the moral instinct, and this happened undoubtedly long ago, so that in most individuals a considerable measure of moral instinct is present. This in its own turn has a tendency to moderate or reduce the intensities of error. Actually, of course, all of these intensities within the individual have flowed out into society where they have produced what we call the common state of man. And these pressures moving out into society have required the building of police forces, fire departments, and numerous other protective mechanisms to save men from each other. Gradually, it has become apparent in action that the subjective pressures of selfishness, self-centeredness, bigotry, and things of that nature produce dangerous consequences in society. In substance, the ignorant individual cannot get along with others and cannot be safe from the ignorance of other people any more than they can be safe from his. Out of this obvious situation, another type of experience mechanism comes into manifestation. By this experience manifestation, the individual learns from his own mistakes. He also learns by seeing other people make his mistakes or similar ones. He observes what happens to them as a result of doing the same things that he does. He observes a common disaster. He finds that others come to the same sorry end that he has. And from this comes the gradual building of the experience of a pattern of utilities, a pattern of things which must be done or must not be done if the general security of the group is to be preserved. As the general security of the group is essential to the comfort of the individual in an organized society, he must gradually take greater and greater cognizance of the group. He must gradually assume his part of the social responsibility for the group. He must cooperate with others. He must contribute to the common productiveness of his kind, or else the general situation deteriorates so rapidly that he himself is imperiled. This is another cycle of information moving in upon the person. So as man lives in a world in which just about anything imaginable can move in upon him, and some things he can't imagine, just as he can not only be moved in upon by realities, but by his own interpretations of realities, he is not only living in space, but he can populate this space with the extensions of his own imagination. And this population can also move in upon him. He is the victim of his own imaginings just as much as he is the victim of factual conditions. And his own imaginings differ from facts to the degree that his own common sense is distorted. Little by little, then, he finds a very interesting and intriguing situation. He is caught in a kind of a vice between an upper and lower millstone. He is unable to completely extricate himself from this constant process of interchange by which new phenomena is continually moving in upon the sensory coordinator. And the coordinator, in turn, is moving out certain impulses, certain instincts, appetites, and attitudes which set up new reactions outside, and these reactions, in turn, move in. It's out, in, out, constantly. This gets to be what might be termed a psychological rat race. Things get more complicated all the time. The individual is like the character in Alice in Wonderland who runs and runs and runs and has to in order to stay where they are. They never seem to be getting very far. And this coordinator changes so slowly and becomes so continuously burdened with external phenomena that it is very difficult to know just exactly what the facts are at any given time. We know, for example, what must have happened to the mental coordinators of millions of German people during World War II, when their entire common sense was completely befuddled by one man, Adolf Hitler. This man's appeal to a certain level of frustration was so great probably one of the best educated groups in the world lost its mind and its common sense. This can happen and can result in the most hideous conditions. All these pressures, however, move in from the outside, and nature has set up the coordinator in the mind to make sure that false pressures do not take over. However, this coordinator is toxic because of the vast amount of false pressure that has already accumulated. It is also without the final means of solution. It is bombarded too continuously, and the individual is doing very little to actually equip this coordinator for its job. Actually, the mind could stand quite a bit of training. But the kind of training it needs, it does not get. So the coordinator has nothing done to help it to grow. It has to work only through trial, error, and suffering. So the time comes when we so-called educate the mind. We send the individual to school for over 20 years on the ground that when we do so, we are now going to have an individual who knows how to think. He graduates, but he does not know how to think. He has been taught, perhaps, to make a living. He has actually been trained out of a large part of his common sense. He has been taught things which have valid meaning only in the small economic and industrial structure which he calls modern society. Anything that might help him, save him, clear him, bring him into organization and integration is probably missing from his education. So the coordinator has no help. It can only continue to take in this tremendous amount of phenomena and try in some way to put it into reasonable order. Most of the reactions of the sensory perceptions have become toxic. The integration is no longer good, and this coordinator, therefore, becomes little better than a bookkeeping system for passing opinions, notions, and pressures. Having achieved so little with its own nature, it then becomes the basis of this thing which we call the self which is merely a symbol of what probably we will have to do next, of the only thought we could have at that particular moment, because it is the only thought